This is Audible.
Highbridge Audio presents Tattoos on the Heart, The Power of Boundless Compassion, written and read by Gregory Boyle. This day with me, paradise. Luke 23, verse 43. Preface. I suppose I've tried to write this book for more than a decade. People encouraged me all the time, but I never felt I had the discipline or blocks of time to do it. I have all these stories and parables locked away in the public storage of my brain, and I have long wanted to find a permanent home for them. The usual containers for these stories are my homilies at Mass in the 25 detention centers where I celebrate the Eucharist, juvenile halls, probation camps, and youth authority facilities. I illustrate the gospel with three stories and usually tell another one just before communion. After Mass once at one of these probation camps, a homie grabbed both my hands and looked me in the eye. "This is my last Mass at camp. I go home on Monday. I'm gonna miss your stories. You tell good stories. And I hope I never have to hear your stories again." Along with my ministry in jails, I give nearly 200 talks a year to social workers, law enforcement, university students, parish groups, and educators. The stories get trotted out there too. They are the bricks around which I hope in this book to slather some thematic mortar that can hold them together. With any luck, they will lift us up so we can see beyond the confines of the things that limit our view. After recently bumping heads with cancer, I started to feel that death might actually not make an exception in my case. So sensing that none of us will get out of this alive, I asked for and was graciously given a 4-month sabbatical by my provincial superior, John McGarry, and sent to Italy. This will explain the ragù de agnello stains on some of the pages that follow. There are several things this book knows it doesn't want to be. It's not a memoir of my past 20-plus years working with gang members. There is no narrative chronology that I'll follow, though I will give a brief aerial view of Dolores' mission and the birth and beginnings of Homeboy Industries. The subsequent stories will need that kind of contextualizing at the gate, as the homies say, if they are to make sense. I would refer the reader to an excellent account of those early days at Dolores Mission in Celeste Fremont's G-Dog and the Homeboys. Her keen portrayal of the young men and women who struggled with this gang phenomenon in the early 90s in that community has now become an even more powerful longitudinal study in the sociology of gangs with her two recent updates of the material. Young gang members write me from all over the country after having read Celeste's book and have been deeply moved by it. Most say it's the only book they have thus far ever read. My book will not be a how to deal with gangs book. It will not lay out a comprehensive plan for a city to prevent and intervene in their burgeoning gang situation. Clearly, the themes that bind the stories together are things that matter to me. As a Jesuit for 38 years and a priest for 26 years, it would not be possible for me to present these stories apart from God, Jesus, compassion, kinship, redemption, mercy, and our common call to delight in one another. If there is a fundamental challenge within these stories, it is simply to change our lurking suspicion that some lives matter less than other lives. William Blake wrote, "We are put on earth for a little space that we might learn to bear the beams of love." Turns out this is what we all have in common, gang member and non-gang member alike. We're just trying to learn how to bear the beams of love. A note on how I've chosen to proceed. In virtually every instance, I have changed the names of the young men and women whose stories fill these pages, with the exception of anecdotes in which the name is the subject of the story. I have also foregone mentioning any specific gang by its name. Too much heartache, pain, and death have been visited upon our communities. To elevate these groupings to any possible fame these pages could bring them. Everything in this book happened, as best as I can recall. I apologize antemano if I have left out some detail, person, or subtle contour that those familiar with these stories would have included. I was born and raised in the gang capital of the world, Los Angeles, California, just west of the area where I have spent nearly a quarter of a century in ministry. I had two wonderful parents, five sisters and two brothers, lived comfortably, went to Catholic private schools, and always had jobs once I was of an age to work. Disneyland was not the happiest place on earth. My home on Norton Avenue was. As a teenager, though, I would not have known a gang member if one came up and, as they say, hit me upside the head. I would not have been able to find a gang if you'd sent me on a scavenger hunt to locate one. It is safe to declare that as a teenager growing up in L.A., it would have been impossible for me to join a gang. That is a fact. That fact, however, does not make me morally superior to the young men and women you will meet in this book. Quite the opposite. I've come to see with greater clarity that the day simply won't come when I am more noble, have more courage, or am closer to God than the folks whose lives fill these pages. In Africa, they say, a person becomes a person through other people. There can be no doubt that the homies have returned me to myself. I've learned with their patient guidance to worship Christ as he lives in them. It's easy to echo Gerard Manley Hopkins here, for I greet him the days I meet him, and bless when I understand. Once, after dealing with a particularly exasperating homie named Sharky, I switch my strategy and decide to catch him in the act of doing the right thing. I can see I have been too harsh and exacting with him, and he is, after all, trying the best he can. I tell him how heroic he is and how the courage he now exhibits in transforming his life far surpasses the hollow bravery of his barrio past. I tell him that he is a giant among men. I mean it. Sharky seems to be thrown off balance by all this and silently stares at me. Then he says, "Damn, G, I'm going to tattoo that on my heart." In finding a home for these stories in this modest effort, I hope, likewise, to tattoo those mentioned here on our collective heart. Though this book does not concern itself with solving the gang problem, it does aspire to broaden the parameters of our kinship. It hopes not only to put a human face on the gang member, but to recognize our own wounds in the broken lives and daunting struggles of the men and women in these parables. Our common human hospitality longs to find room for those who are left out. It's just who we are, if allowed to foster something different, something more greatly resembling what God had in mind. Perhaps together we can teach each other how to bear the beams of love, persons becoming persons, right before our eyes, returned to ourselves. Tattoos on the Heart. Introduction. Dolores Mission and Homeboy Industries. I spent the summers of 1984 and 1985 as an associate pastor at Dolores Mission Church, the poorest parish in the Los Angeles Archdiocese. In 1986, I became pastor of the church. Originally, I was scheduled to go to Santa Clara University to run their student service program. But Bolivia changed all that. I can't explain how the poor in Bolivia evangelized me during that year of 1984-85, but they turned me inside out, and from that moment forward, I only wanted to walk with them. This was a wholly selfish decision on my part, I knew that the poor had some privileged delivery system for giving me access to the gospel. Naturally, I wanted to be around this. When I raised this desire to work with the poor with my provincial superior, I was sent to Dolores Mission instead of Santa Clara, as the youngest pastor in the history of the diocese. The church had been in Boyle Heights for some 40 years, nestled in the middle of two large public housing projects, Pico Gardens and Aliso Village. Together, they comprise the largest grouping of public housing west of the Mississippi. When I arrived, we had 8 active gangs, 7 Latino and 1 African American. The projects were 25% African American back in 1986 and are now 99.9% Latino. At the time, the Pico Aliso area was known to have the highest concentration of gang activity in the entire city. If Los Angeles was the gang capital of the world, our little postage stamp size area on the map was the gang capital of L.A. I buried my first young person killed because of gang violence in 1988. And as of this writing, I have been called upon for this sad task an additional 172 times. The first kid I buried was an 18-year-old identical twin. Even the family had a hard time distinguishing these two brothers from each other. At the funeral, Vicente peered into the casket of his brother Danny. They were both wearing identical clothes. It was as if someone had slapped a mirror down and Vicente was staring at his own reflection. Because this was my first funeral of this kind, the snapshot of a young man peering at his own mirror image has stayed with me all these years as a metaphor for gang violence and all its self-destruction. At the time, there were so many gang-involved middle school kids who had been given the boot from their schools that their constant presence in the projects during school hours brought violence and major drug dealing. So the first thing we did as a parish community to respond to this gang reality was to open our alternative school, Dolores Mission Alternative, or DMA, in 1988. The school drew different gangs and their members to the third floor of Dolores Mission's elementary school in what used to be the convent. Fights were daily occurrences and keeping staff was a challenge. We had a principal last 2 days and several teachers who hung in there for just one. With the school came a new parish attitude. Suddenly, the welcome mat was tentatively placed out front. A new sense of church had emerged, open and inclusive, replacing the hermetically sealed model that had kept the good folks in and the bad folks out. The Christian-based communities, Comunidades Eclesiales de Base, or CEBs, were sectors of people in the parish, mainly women, who reflected on the gospel as it impacted their real lives. Their reflection compelled them to extend themselves to the gangs in their area of the projects. They would have carne asadas and other gatherings to communicate clearly that the gang members were not our enemies. One CEB even had a Thanksgiving dinner for homies who had no place to go. They wanted to signal to the gang members, "You are our sons and daughters, whether we brought you into this world or not." I can remember standing outside police tape on an early Sunday morning just around the block from the church. The body of a gang member was lying on the ground, partially covered with a sheet. His head and upper torso were draped with the sheet, revealing only his oversized, cut-off Dickies shorts, white tube socks pulled up to the knee, and a pair of blue Nike Cortez, all standard-issue gang wear at the time. He wasn't from the projects, and who knows why he wandered into this foreign turf. Pam McDuffie, an activist mother in the community, sidled up to me and put her arm around my waist. She was crying. "I don't know who that kid is, but he was some mother's son." Soon gang members began to kick it at the church. The garage became a quasi-weight room, and the bell tower always had some 10 gang members or so huddled there, smoking cigarettes and passing the time. I figured if they're at the church, they're not wreaking havoc in the community. This didn't thrill all parishioners, and the grumbling reached a pitch that forced me to call a parish meeting. The parish hall was packed. This would be either a vote of confidence in my leadership, or an opportunity for the parishioners to tell me, "Here's your hat, what's your hurry?" I didn't speak, but the E.F. Huttons of the community, when they spoke, people tended to listen. Teresa Navarro and Paula Hernandez needed only to stand and invoke Jesus. We help gang members at this parish because it is what Jesus would do. People applauded, and the parish never looked back. Soon the women organized major marches or caminatas, moving through the projects, often in the heat of tension and in the wake of ceaseless shooting. The Comité Pro Paz, or Committee for Peace, as the women called themselves, would move to hot spots, and their gentle praying and singing presence would calm the gang members ready for battle. It was one such march that gave birth to Homeboy Industries in 1988. Armed with flyers reading "Jobs for a Future," hundreds of women walked to the factories surrounding the housing projects, and with this show of force, handed a flyer to the foreman of each factory. It had become clear that what gang members most requested were jobs. Having a jale, or a job, was all they ever talked about. We waited for the factories to call with employment offers, but this never happened. Still, an organization was born, Jobs for a Future, which initially sought gainful employment for the gang members from Pico Aliso. This parish-led program soon launched projects that hired huge swaths of gang members. The building of a child care center, neighborhood cleanup crews, and graffiti removal, landscaping, and maintenance crews. Gang members were placed in a variety of businesses and nonprofits, and Jobs for a Future paid their salaries. I wrote more rubber checks than a U.S. congressperson. We constantly lived in the paradox of precariousness. The money was never there when you needed it, and it was always on time. It was during this period that I promoted any number of truces, ceasefires, and peace treaties. I spent a great deal of time in a kind of shuttle diplomacy, riding my bike between neighborhoods. Or as gang members do, I use interchangeably the words gang, barrio, and neighborhood. They all refer to gang. Securing signed agreements from the warring factions. Some were Pyrrhic victories, such as an agreement not to shoot into houses. I learned early on that all sides would speak so positively about the peace process when first approached. "Yeah, G," what most homies call me, short for Greg. "Let's get a peace treaty going." But once you brought them together, they couldn't resist posturing in high gear in front of one another. I eventually ceased having these meetings, and like the Soviet Union and the USA, I worked out all the details of peace beforehand and just had the principals sign the agreements. That was then. This is now. Though I don't regret having orchestrated these truces and treaties, I'd never do it again. The unintended consequence of it all was that it legitimized the gangs and fed them oxygen. I eventually came to see that this kind of work keeps gangs alive. The unrest of 1992 was unlike anything I'd ever seen in Los Angeles. Working my paper corner as a sixth grader during the Watts riots in 1965, I had a sense then of containment that this was unrest happening over there. Not so in 1992. The sky, blackened with smoke, reached every corner of the city. I sat on the stoop of an apartment in Pico Gardens with a huge gang member, a shock caller. When all the other homies were out of earshot, he turned to me and said, "This is the end of the world, isn't it, G?" His voice trembling and uncertain. I reassured him. "No, of course it isn't." But I wasn't at all sure that he was wrong. The National Guard arrived in our project several days after the initial explosion of things, but we didn't need them there. Things didn't explode in this, the poorest of communities in Los Angeles, where everyone fully expected mayhem. I suspect the reason they didn't was that we had so many strategically employed gang members who finally had a stake in keeping the projects from igniting, that the peace was kept. Because I said as much in a Los Angeles Times interview about the riot, Ray Stark summoned me. Ray was a hugely successful Hollywood agent, Humphrey Bogart, Kirk Douglas, and a mega-hit movie producer, Funny Girl. His beloved wife, Fran, had died shortly before our visit, and Ray wanted to make an impact on this burgeoning and daunting gang issue. At our meeting, Ray suggested some ideas that I had to respectfully dismiss. Finally, after I'd swatted down a number of these suggestions, for example, arm gang members with their own video cameras so we could make a documentary, Ray was exasperated. "I give up. What do you think I should do with my money?" I told him that an old bakery was for sale across the street from the church. He could buy it, and we could bring rival gang members together. We could call it the Homeboy Bakery. Ray was electrified, and so we began the economic development branch of Jobs for a Future. Some months later, we commandeered a tortilla machine in the Grand Central Market, and now with multiple businesses, we became Homeboy Industries, no longer Jobs for a Future, in the summer of 1992. Our first office was on the church property, but our second was the storefront at 1848 East 1st Street, from 1994 to 2000. White Memorial Hospital, long supporters of my work with gang members, paid my rent. It was here that gang members from all the 40-plus gangs in the Hollenbeck Police Division, some 10,000 members, began to arrive, looking for a way out of the gang life. Perhaps gang members had always longed for this, but for the absence of a place to go, the desire had festered. Soon, we added staff and job developers to locate employment in the private sector. We began tattoo removal because of a guy named Ramiro. A gang member fresh out of prison with a long record had "fuck the world" tattooed on his forehead, completely filling the space there. He told me his job search was not going so great. I'm only imagining him at McDonald's, "Do you want fries with that?" and seeing mothers grab their kids fleeing the store. So I hired him at the bakery, and little by little we erased his forehead. We have since added many laser machines and doctors who perform more than 4,000 treatments a year. We owe it all to Ramiro, who moved on to a job as a security guard at a movie studio, no trace left of the angriest moment in his life. Businesses have come and gone at Homeboy Industries. We have had starts and stops, but anything worth doing is worth failing at. We started Homeboy Plumbing. That didn't go so well. Who knew? People didn't want gang members in their homes. I just didn't see that coming. At the turn of the century, we needed more space, so we moved to our third headquarters up the block at 1916 East 1st Street, into a rehabbed printing factory. After a while, we started serving gang members outside Boyle Heights as well, and we now had 1,000 folks a month from 45 different zip codes. Members from more than 800 gangs from all over the county now came seeking employment, tattoo removal, mental health counseling, case management, and legal services. By 2007, we had so burst our seams that we built our current headquarters, Homeboy Bakery and Homegirl Cafe, near Chinatown in downtown Los Angeles. Our most successful business is Homeboy Silkscreen, ably run all these years by Ruben and Christina Rodriguez. And we operate four others, Homeboy Bakery, Homeboy Homegirl Merchandising, Homeboy Maintenance, and Homegirl Cafe, where women with records, young ladies from rival gangs, waitresses with attitude, will gladly take your order. Los Angeles County claims 1,100 gangs with nearly 86,000 members. A great number of these youth know to come to Homeboy when they are ready to hang up their gloves. Homeboy Industries is not for those who need help, only for those who want it. In this sense, we are a gang rehabilitation center. Often the homies who come to us are not ready for primetime players. Just released from prison, they are offered what is often their first jobs, where they glean soft skills at Homeboy Industries, like learning to show up on time every day and taking orders from disagreeable supervisors. We provide all of this free of charge. We are a work site and therapeutic community. We are a training program and business. We are all of the above at the same time. Once the homies come to feel some confidence in the workplace, they can move on to higher paying opportunities elsewhere. Also, we give homies a chance to work with their enemies. The place has become the United Nations of gangs. When enemies work with one another, a valuable disconnect is created on the streets. It forces a fellow active gang member to ask the employed homie, "How can you work with that guy?" Answering that question will be awkward, clumsy, and always require courage. But the question itself jostles the status quo. Finally, Homeboy Industries can only hire and help a finite number of gang members. Though thousands have found assistance, it remains a tiny drop in a pretty deep bucket. In the city of Los Angeles, Homeboy Industries has operated as a symbol as much as a place of concrete help. For more than 20 years, it has asked this city, "What if we were to invest in gang members rather than just seek to incarcerate our way out of this problem?" After 2 decades, the city of Los Angeles has embraced Homeboy Industries as its own and has allowed it to shape how we see this condition and how we can, in part, respond to it. A homie named David, who had sunk to homelessness and heroin addiction, was beating himself up one day. "Look, David," I tell him, wanting to cut his meat up for him, "you have to crawl before you can walk, and then walk before you can run." David's eyes soften with tears. "Yeah, but I know I can fly. I just need to catch a gust of wind." Homeboy Industries wants to be that gust. The poet Denise Levertov writes, "It's when we face for a moment the worst our kind can do, and shudder to know the taint in our own selves, that awe cracks the mind's shell and enters the heart." In 1992, Homeboy Bakery is launched. But 7 years later, in October of 1999, it burns to the ground. I get the panicky call at 3 a.m. with the news. I arrive to find the bakery surrounded by fire trucks, hoses shooting water everywhere, flames stretching high. Women from the projects across the street greet me and wrap me in their arms. Tearfully, they promise that when the sun comes up, they will have a venta de comida and begin the fundraising. A young girl hugs me, crying, "Don't worry, G, we'll have a car wash." I must admit, initially, I thought it was arson. When I say this, people often presume I mean that gang members did it. I never thought that. Homeboy Bakery stood as a symbol of hope to every gang member in the county. That they would destroy this place of second chances didn't make sense. But we had a lot of enemies in those early days. Folks who felt that assisting gang members somehow co-signed on their bad behavior. Hate mail, death threats, and bomb threats were common, especially after I wrote op-ed pieces in the Los Angeles Times, which I had done just prior to the fire. We used to joke during this period of hostility that emanated from those who opposed the very idea of Homeboy that with so much vitriol leveled at us, we ought to change our voicemail message after hours. "Thank you for calling Homeboy Industries. Your bomb threat is important to us." From my office once, I heard a homegirl answer the phone, and she says to the caller, "Go ahead, bring that bomb, motherfucker. We're ready for your ass." I ask her who's on the phone. She covers the receiver, nonplussed. "Oh, just some fool who wants to blow the place up. Kiddo, I tell her, maybe we should just say, have a nice day and God bless you." The day of the bakery fire, within an hour of my arrival, the fire inspectors are able with certainty to deem the cause of the fire to be natural. The place was 80 years old, after all, with wiring from aquel tiempo. An electrical short traveled through the walls, took a breather in the bakery's office, long enough to percolate, and soon the whole place imploded. But of course we don't know all this in the first half hour, and during this time of not knowing, a wizened, Irish-looking fire inspector comes over to me. "You the owner?" he asks, flames shooting through the roof of the bakery behind him. "Yeah." He says, "You got any reason to believe why someone might have started this fire?" "No." "You didn't have any disgruntled ex-employees, did you?" "No," I tell him. "All the disgruntled ones still work for me." I needed to break the tension, even if he didn't need to. He does not smile. "You know this area where the bakery's located?" He surveys it with a whisper, turning his head from side to side. "Well, it's known for hoodlums." Like this might come as a surprise to me. "Well," I tell him, "I think we're okay here, 'cause at Homeboy Industries," now I'm the one whispering, "we only hire hoodlums." Again, no smiling. The next day we were able to inform all the bakers what happened, but we couldn't locate one of them, a kid named Lencho. So when the time came for his shift to begin, Lencho steps off the bus, wearing his perfectly planchado white uniform, with the words Homeboy Bakery embroidered on one side, and his name, Lencho, emblazoned on the other. His step is light as he walks to the parking lot. But once he enters, he sees the soggy mess extracted by the firefighters. He sees smoke still wafting through the sizable hole in the roof. He sees his co-workers, all rivals from enemy gangs, picking through the rubble. No one needs to explain. He stands there frozen, puts his head in his hands, and begins to sob. This was his reason to get up in the morning. Just as important, it was his reason not to gangbang the night before. The union he shared with his co-workers, former enemies, was deeper than anything he had ever known in his family, and certainly stronger than the bond he knew in his gang. All we could do was surround him with love and the promise of rebuilding. 10 years later, he is back, working in the brand new bakery. The original bakery was hugely famous from its first week. News crews would visit almost daily. Articles were written with photos of enemies working alongside one another. Tour groups came from all over the world. Busloads of Japanese tourists dropped by. Even Prince Charles's business advisors swooped down on us. Pip, pip, cheerio meets the homies. Our foreman at the time was a man named Luis, in his mid-20s, who arguably had been among the biggest, savviest drug dealers our community had ever known. We knew each other for more than a decade, and any offer of a job was always graciously but surely declined. Luis was as smart as they come, and quick-witted. He used to say, "When we were kids, we would play kick the can, but so did the cops. You know, they'd play kick the Mexican or kick the Puerto Rican." He never got caught. Too smart. If the cops rolled by and he was standing with me, he'd mumble, "Beam me up, Scotty." But when his daughter Tiffany was born, things changed. He wanted to work at the bakery, and his natural leadership ability soon moved him up to foreman. Not only did he work with former rivals, he also supervised them, which is a great deal more difficult. One day we received an odd request for a tour from farmers from the Central Valley of California. They wanted to see the bakery. It was part of Luis's job description to greet the busloads and the film crews. He hates this part of his job, and his whining could make your teeth ache. "Do I gotta?" The day the farmers arrive, he and I are waiting for the bus to pull up, and I'm swinging at his whiny complaints like a bunch of pesky gnats. Finally, the bus drives into the awkward bakery parking lot, and I wave and direct it to its reserved spot. It's one of those ultra-modern buses, sleek and slick, equipped with a microphone at the front of the bus for the tour guide. Luis pretends he's the tour guide. "Welcome to Homeboy Bakery," his voice nasally drones with tour guide disinterest. "Observe gang members in their natural habitat." He is holding his fist up to his mouth for greater amplification. "Please keep your hands in the bus at all times. Do not attempt to feed the homies. They are not yet tame." "Cállate, cabrón," I say through the part of my mouth not smiling, welcoming our visitors from the farmland as they get off the bus. Later in the day, I visit the bakery several blocks from my office. Seeing Luis triggers the memory of his earlier tour. "Oye," I ask him, "how'd the tour go?" "Damn, G," he shakes his head. "What's up with white people anyway?" I was actually curious as to what was up with us. "I don't know. What is up with us?" "I mean, damn," he says, "they always be using the word great." "We do?" "Oh, hell yeah. Watch out. There's a bunch of gabachos strolling here and see the place, and it's all firme and clean and machines working proper, and they say, 'This place is great.' And then they see the homies, tú sabes, enemies working together all firme, and they say, 'You fellas are great.' Then they taste our bread, and they go, 'This bread, it's great.' I mean, damn, G, why white people always be using the word great?" I tell him I don't know, but trust me, every opportunity I could find after that, I tell him how great he is, just to mess with him a little. Some 4 months later, it's nearly closing time, and I arrive at the bakery in the evening. Luis sees me in the parking lot from inside the building and rushes outside. He's excited, and yet enthusiasm is not ever the card with which Luis leads. He's too cool for that. He barely lets me out of my car. "Hey, G," he says, thrilled to see me, "you're not gonna believe what happened to me yesterday after my shift." He proceeds to tell me that after work he goes to pick up his 4-year-old daughter Tiffany at the babysitter's. He puts her in the car, and they drive to their tiny apartment, where, for the very first time, Luis is paying rent with honestly earned, clean money. He unlocks the front door, and Tiffany scurries in down the hallway and lands in their modest sala. She plants her feet in the living room and extends her arms and takes in the whole room with her eyes. She then declares, with an untethered smile, "This is great." He turns and says to me, I thought she was turning white on me. He tells me that he lowers himself to her eye level, placing his hands on his knees for support. "What's great, mija?" Tiffany clutches her heart and gushes, "My home!" Luis seems to be unable to speak at exactly this moment. Our eyes find each other, and our souls well up along with our eyes. We can't stop staring at each other, and tears make their way south on our faces. After what seems like longer than I'm sure it was, I break the silence. I point at him. "You did this. You've never had a home in your life, and now you have one. You did this. You were the biggest drug dealer in town, and you stopped and baked bread instead. You did this. You've never had a father in your life, and now you are one. And I hate to have to tell you, but you're great. And I hate to have to tell you this, but the first time I retrieved this story from my memory bank was to tell it at Luis's funeral. He wasn't doing anything wrong on the Wednesday afternoon he was killed. He was loading the trunk of his car in the projects, readying himself for a camping trip with friends. Two gang members, with their faces covered, entered their enemy's territory, looking for fools slipping. They saw Luis and must have thought to themselves, "He'll do." They walked up to him and executed him. I told the great story at Luis's funeral largely because of the questions I had been repeatedly asked by his friends and homies during the week that spanned his death and burial. "What's the point," they'd ask, "of doing good if this can happen to you?" It was a good question, worthy of a response. I told that packed church that Luis was a human being who came to know the truth about himself and liked what he found there. Julian of Norwich, a 14th-century female English mystic, saw the life struggle as coming to discover that we are clothed in God's goodness. This became Luis's life's work. He embraced this goodness, his greatness, and nothing was the same again. And really, what is death compared to knowing that? No bullet can pierce it. The poet Hafez writes in a poem titled, "With That Moon Language," "Admit something. Everyone you see, you say to them, 'Love me.' Of course, you do not do this out loud, otherwise someone would call the cops. Still, though, think about this, this great pull in us to connect. Why not become the one who lives with a full moon in each eye that is always saying with that sweet moon language what every other eye in this world is dying to hear?" Chapter 1. God, I guess. God can get tiny if we're not careful. I'm certain we all have an image of God that becomes the touchstone, the controlling principle to which we return when we stray. My touchstone image of God comes by way of my friend and spiritual director, Bill Kane. Years ago, he took a break from his own ministry to care for his father as he died of cancer. His father had become a frail man, dependent on Bill to do everything for him. Though he was physically not what he had been, and the disease was wasting him away, his mind remained alert and lively. In the role reversal common to adult children who care for their dying parents, Bill would put his father to bed and then read him to sleep, exactly as his father had done for him in childhood. Bill would read from some novel, and his father would lie there, staring at his son, smiling. Bill was exhausted from the day's care and work and would plead with his dad, "Look, here's the idea. I read to you, you fall asleep." Bill's father would impishly apologize and dutifully close his eyes, but this wouldn't last long. Soon enough, Bill's father would pop one eye open and smile at his son. Bill would catch him and whine, "Now come on." The father would again oblige until he couldn't anymore, and the other eye would open to catch a glimpse of his son. This went on, and after his father's death, Bill knew that this evening ritual was really a story of a father who just couldn't take his eyes off his kid. How much more so God. Anthony DeMello writes, "Behold the one beholding you and smiling." God would seem to be too occupied in being unable to take her eyes off of us to spend any time raising an eyebrow in disapproval. What's true of Jesus is true for us. And so this voice breaks through the clouds and comes straight at us. "You are my beloved, in whom I am wonderfully pleased." There is not much tiny in that. In 1990, the television news program 60 Minutes came to Dolores Mission Church. One of its producers had read a Sunday Los Angeles Times Magazine article about my work with gang members in the housing projects. Mike Wallace, also seeing the piece, wanted to do a report. I was assured that I'd be getting good Mike. These were the days when the running joke was, you know you're going to have a bad day when Mike Wallace and a 60 Minutes film crew show up at your office. Wallace arrived at the poorest parish in Los Angeles in the stretchest of white limousines, stepped out of the car wearing a flak jacket covered with pockets, prepared, I suppose, for a journey into the jungle. For all his initial insensitivity, toward the end of the visit, in a moment unrecorded, Wallace did say to me, "Can I admit something? I came here expecting monsters, but that's not what I found." Later, in a recorded moment, we are sitting in a classroom filled with gang members, all students in our Dolores Mission Alternative School. Wallace points at me and says, "You won't turn these guys into the police," which seems quite silly to me at the time. I say something lame like, "I didn't take my vows to the LAPD. But then Wallace turns to a homie and grills him on this, saying over and over, "He won't turn you in, will he?" And then he asks the homie, "Why is that? Why do you think he won't turn you over to the police?" The kid just stares at Mike Wallace, shrugs, nonplussed, and says, "God, I guess." This is a chapter on God, I guess. Truth be told, the whole book is. Not much in my life makes any sense outside of God. Certainly, a place like Homeboy Industries is all folly and bad business, unless the core of the endeavor seeks to imitate the kind of God one ought to believe in. In the end, I'm helpless to explain why anyone would accompany those on the margins, were it not for some anchored belief that the ground of all being thought this was a good idea. Rascal is not one to take advice. He can be recalcitrant, defensive, and primed for the fight. Well into his 30s, he's a survivor. His truck gets filled with scrap metal, and with this, somehow, he feeds his kids and manages to stay on this side of eviction. To his credit, he bid prison time and gangbanging goodbye a long time ago. Rascal sometimes hits me up for funds, and I oblige if I have it, and if his attitude doesn't foul my mood too much. But you can't tell him anything, except this one day he actually listens. I'm going on about something, can't remember what, but I can see he's listening. When I'm done, he says simply, "You know, I'm going to take that advice, and I'm going to let it marinate," pointing at his heart, "right here." Perhaps we should all marinate in the intimacy of God. Genesis, I suppose, got it right. In the beginning, God. Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits, also spoke about the task of marinating in the God who is always greater. He writes, "Take care always to keep before your eyes first God." The secret, of course, of the ministry of Jesus was that God was at the center of it. Jesus chose to marinate in the God who is always greater than our tiny conception, the God who loves without measure and without regret. To anchor yourself in this, to keep always before your eyes this God, is to choose to be intoxicated, marinated in the fullness of God. An Algerian Trappist, before his martyrdom, spoke to this fullness. "When you fill my heart, my eyes overflow." Willie crept up on me from the driver's side. I had just locked the office, and I was ready to head home at 8 p.m. "Shit, Willie," I say. "Don't be doing that." "Spencer G," he says. "My bad. It's just, well, my stomach's on edge, Charlie. Kick me down with 20 bones, yeah?" "Dog, my wallet's on edge, Charlie," I tell him. A dog is the one upon whom you can rely, the roll dog, the person who has your back. "But get in. Let's see if I can trick any funds out of the ATM." Willie hops on board. He is a life force of braggadocio and posturing, a thoroughly good soul. But his confidence is outsize, that of a lion wanting you to know he just swallowed a man whole. A gang member, but a peripheral one at best. He wants more to regale you with his exploits than to actually be in the midst of any. In his mid-20s, Willie is a charmer, a quintessential homey con man who's apt to coax money out of your ATM if you let him. This night, I'm tired, I want to go home. It's easier not to resist. The Food for Less on 4th and Soto has the closest ATM. I tell Willie to stay in the car in case we run into one of Willie's rivals inside. Stay here, dog, I tell him. I'll be right back. I'm not 10 feet away when I hear a muffled, "Hey!" It's Willie, and he's miming, "The keys!" from the passenger seat of my car. He's making over-the-top key in the ignition señales. "The radio!" he mouths as he holds a hand, cupping his ear. I wag a finger. "No! Chale!" Then it's my turn to mime. I hold both hands together and enunciate exaggeratedly. "Pray!" Willie sighs and levitates his eyeballs, but he's putty. He assumes the praying hands pose and looks heavenward. "Cara santucha." I proceed on my quest to the ATM, but feel the need to check in on Willie only 10 yards later. I turn, and I find him still in the prayer position, seeming to be only half aware that I'm looking in on him. I return to the car, $20 in hand, and get in. Something has happened here. Willie is quiet, reflective, and there's a palpable sense of peace in the vehicle. I look at Willie and say, "You prayed, didn't you?" He doesn't look at me. He's still and quiet. "Yeah, I did." I start the car. "Well, what did God say to you?" I ask him. "Well, first he said, shut up and listen." "So what you do?" "Come on, G," he says. "What am I supposed to do? I shut up and listened." I begin to drive him home to the barrio. I've never seen Willie like this. He's quiet and humble. No need to convince me of anything or talk me out of something else. "So, son, tell me something," I ask. "How do you see God?" "God," he says, "that's my dog right there." "And God," I ask, "how does God see you?" Willie doesn't answer at first. So I turn and watch as he rests his head on the recliner, staring at the ceiling of my car. A tear falls down his cheek. Heart full, eyes overflowing. "God thinks I'm firme." To the homies, firme means could not be one bit better. Not only does God think we're firme, it is God's joy to have us marinate in that. The poet Kabir asks, "What is God?" And then he answers his own question. God is the breath inside the breath. Willie found his way inside the breath, and it was firme. I came late to this understanding in my own life, helped along by the grace-filled pedagogy of the people of Dolores Mission. I was brought up and educated to give assent to certain propositions. God is love, for example. You concede God loves us, and yet there is this lurking sense that perhaps you aren't fully part of the us. The arms of God reach to embrace, and somehow you feel yourself just outside God's fingertips. Then you have no choice but to consider that God loves me. Yet you spend much of your life unable to shake off what feels like God only embracing you begrudgingly and reluctantly. I suppose, if you insist, God has to love me too. Then who can explain this next moment, when the utter fullness of God rushes in on you, when you completely know the one in whom you move and live and have your being, as St. Paul writes? You see then that it has been God's joy to love you all along. And this is completely new. Every time one of the Jesuits at Dolores Mission would celebrate a birthday, the same ritual would repeat itself. You know, one of the other Jesuits would say to me, for example, your birthday is Wednesday. The people are throwing a surprise party for you on the Saturday before. The protests are as predictable as the festivities. Oh, come on, I'd say. Can't we pass this year? Look, one of my brothers would say to me, this party is not for you. It's for the people. And so I'm led into the parish hall for some bogus meeting, and I can hear the people shushing one another. El padre ya viene. As I step in the door, lights go on, people shout, mariachis strike themselves up. I'm called upon to muster up the same award-winning look of shock from last year. They know that you know. They don't care. They don't just love you. It's their joy to love you. The poet Rumi writes, find the real world, give it endlessly away. Grow rich, flinging gold to all who ask. Live at the empty heart of paradox. I'll dance there with you, cheek to cheek. Dancing cumbias with the women of Dolores Mission rhymes with God's own wild desire to dance with each one of us cheek to cheek. Meister Eckhart says, God is greater than God. The hope is that our sense of God will grow as expansive as our God is. Each tiny conception gets obliterated as we discover more and more the God who is always greater. At Camp Page, a county detention facility near Glendora, I was getting to know 15-year-old Rigo, who was about to make his first communion. The Catholic volunteers had found him a white shirt and black tie. We still had some 15 minutes before the other incarcerated youth would join us for Mass in the gym. And I'm asking Rigo the basic stuff about his family and his life. I ask about his father. Oh, he says, he's a heroin addict. Never really been in my life. Used to always beat my ass. Fact, he's in prison right now. Barely ever lived with us. Then something kind of snaps in him. An image brings him to attention. I think I was in the fourth grade, he begins. I came home. Sent home in the middle of the day. Got into some pedo at school. I can't remember what. When I got home, my jefito was there. He was hardly ever there. My dad says, why they send you home? And 'cause my dad always beat me, I said, if I tell you, promise you won't hit me. He just said, I'm your father. Of course I'm not going to hit you. So I told him. Rigo is caught short in the telling. He begins to cry. And in moments, he's wailing and rocking back and forth. I put my arm around him. He is inconsolable. When he is able to speak, and barely so, he says only, he beat me with a pipe. With a pipe! When Rigo composes himself, I ask, and your mom? He points some distance from where we are to a tiny woman standing by the gym's entrance. That's her over there, he pauses for a beat. There's no one like her. Again, some slide appears in his mind, and a thought occurs. I've been locked up for more than a year and a half. She comes to see me every Sunday. You know how many buses she takes every Sunday? To see my sorry ass. Then quite unexpectedly, he sobs with the same ferocity as before. Again, it takes him some time to reclaim breath and ability to speak. Then he does, gasping through his tears. 7 buses. She takes 7 buses. Imagine. How then to imagine the expansive heart of this God, greater than God, who takes 7 buses just to arrive at us. We settle sometimes for less than intimacy with God, when all God longs for is this solidarity with us. In Spanish,